Ezra, why are we here today?
It's our usual reason, Ray. This is a big win. We recorded another fascinating two-part episode with one of our colleagues. This time, it's with our dear friend, Lily Tsai, the Ford Professor of Political Science. This is part two of this episode.
All right, so let's go.
In my research, I've been really, interested for decades about what builds trust and credibility and how do people acquire moral authority and legitimacy. And one of the things that I've come to realize through my research is that one way of building trust and credibility is to stand up or take actions, make expressions, make statements that don't benefit you personally, that are not in your self-interest, that sometimes are even costly to you. And in my personal choices about how to make the most of the time and effort that I devote to advocacy and hopefully making a positive impact, I more often than not try to, at least, in my public-facing activities, focus on supporting groups that really have nothing to do with my own personal identity. Because I think that there is some important social science research that suggests that people often assume that when you're advocating for your own identity group, that you're self-interested, right? So if you're advocating for a group that has nothing to do with any of the identities that you might be assumed to have, you're actually seen to have more credibility and moral authority. And so since I'm trying to have as much positive impact, given the time and effort that I have, it often makes sense to advocate for groups that don't share an identity characteristic with me.
We can get into, and dilemmas you might have faced in taking on the role, right? I thought about these issues over the years a little bit in terms of like maybe a trade-off, though I don't know exactly where the trade-off kind of how it plays. There's a sharp counterexample, I think, that's out there in the culture, which is sort of a white savior kind of complex, right? So there are examples out there of, we are wary of certain kinds of people, say, in the historical system of racial domination and privilege, who we might suspect their motives, right? And maybe their empathy or their ability to help out. And so being something of an outsider, we're talking about outsiders and insiders, the fact they're not out for themselves might actually be a suspect. And the related question I guess I have is, I guess I've thought about this often, is in terms of the legal doctrine of standing, right? And so in courts, in our judicial system, I think in many, right, who has standing to bring a suit? It has to be someone who actually is sort of an insider in a sense, right? Someone who is directly impacted by the harm. So I don't know how to think exactly about that trade-off, but I'm curious how you think about when an outsider, in some sense, taking on the needs and interests of someone else, those costly signals might be credible. They might be.
Yeah, Ezra. But Ezra.
Yeah.
Let's not forget our student Summer Jackson, who thinks about this hard question.
Yeah. And it relates, I think, to Lily's research too.
I'd love to hear about Summer's research. I was actually thinking of our colleague Rebecca Sachs's research that I talk about in my most recent book. I talk about how politicians are often able to build credibility by punishing those who are in their own party so that they really come across as having integrity and moral authority.
She's rise to power, right?
She's rise to power. Yes, exactly. He started out by punishing those in his own faction. And, conversely, when politicians start to punish those in the other party, it starts to look politically motivated and self-interested, and they lose credibility. Rebecca actually has recently done some experimental work that shows something similar, which is that people are assessing the action of an authority who's in imposing some sort of punishment along four dimensions simultaneously. So they're trying to figure out whether the punishment is legitimate. They're also trying to figure out whether the rule that the violator is being punished for is should they think of the rule as legitimate or should they think of the punisher as illegitimate, right? So either the rule is legitimate and the punisher is punishing legitimately, or the punisher is illegitimate and just abusing their power. In order to figure that out, they're also updating on whether or not the punisher is biased towards the group that they're punishing. And fourth, whether the punisher is self-interested. They're gaining something at the same, they're gaining something, political capital, whatever, through this punishment. So people are trying to assess all of four of those things at the same time. And when, I guess when I think about what you refer to as, is it white savior complex? I think that people would see those who are, you know, accused of being, quote, white saviors as being self-interested actually in some way. Like they have something to gain, whether it's, you know, quote, virtue signaling or moral credentialing by being the white savior. And I guess I think about the ways of allying without necessarily speaking on behalf of any kind of, there is this sense in which the quote, white savior knows better or speaks on behalf of, you know, swoops in to save the day. Whereas that's quite different, I think, from lending support, whether it's behind the scenes or next to or behind. So that's how I think about it. But yeah.
I think that's important. I think that's a very important dynamic to point out, right? Is that in a sense, you know, to do it effectively is to acknowledge that you have a privilege to influence a process without claiming that you know just as much, if not more, about the people that you're advocating for.
It's interesting to go back to our first two episodes, Ray and Lily. I think what you're describing here, what Lily is presenting, is consistent in the sense that, you know, each of us saw something as an outsider that was actually like shed some light on something that maybe the insider couldn't see. But the thing I was going to ask is, you know, the principle that you're advocating, Lily, it's not always so easy to put in practice, right? So, for instance, there are cases in which you might be the only one in the room that can speak for that, for the group, the identity you're trying to help, you know, whatever the circumstances is, they may not be there. And then we get to issues of representation that, you know, that Ray's been emphasizing in his work, right? So there's going to be, and I'm thinking also of the paper of Summers, Ray, you know, if the folks are not represented. And so you're now in position to, in some sense, speak if they're not in the room. And so there must be occasions too, where you are a certain kind of advocate speaking on their behalf, obviously with a lot of caveats and whatnot. But there is a role, I think, for that ally to be a spokesperson of a sort, I would think, under some circumstances, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I might even go a little further. I mean, I do feel like there are some times when people are uncomfortable speaking on behalf of themselves. I think that there is a role, as you're saying, Ezra, like a, you can see that even if that person is in the room, they don't want to come out and say, they don't want to come out and speak on behalf of their group. Or
yeah. Let me give you an example that I can think of, which is years ago. Let's think about hierarchy for a second, right? So one reason why they may not be able to speak is because, you know, three of us are senior faculty. And I know one thing we're all sensitive to is like when you've got junior faculty who don't have tenure, which is, that's the distinction, you know, for those of you who are not so well-versed in our little tiny corner of the world. So there's a major, you know, difference between having tenure and not having tenure is, you know, night and day. Tenure means you have lifetime job security. It's quite a privilege. And there are plenty of people on our faculty and staff, and it's not even a thing they could get. But if you're junior faculty, you're potentially could get tenure. You know, and I'm thinking of a case, let's just say it may be here, maybe somewhere else, but where the junior faculty member was quite religious. And religious Christian in this case. And they, I would say, were hazed in a certain kind of way by other members of the faculty about, and I've seen all kinds of hazing that's very, you know, people aren't thinking about it. You might call it a microaggression now in one way or another. But like, people were talking in a crude way that I knew was quite offensive. And I, at the time, felt, you know, I was myself was junior, but I felt quite ashamed for our community, for our institution. And I would like to think, you know, knowing what I know about him and the situation that he was also quite shy. He was also an underrepresented minority. Maybe I should have spoken up anyway. And, you know, I felt quite, still to this day, ashamed of my inability to speak in some sense on their behalf, at least in some way, or help them, you know, speak for themselves. And so I think that's very common, right?
Yeah, sometimes people just need a nudge. And I think we're having this conversation. I suspect we're having this conversation because we need some of those nudges right now. We're fragmented as a community. And so in a sense, we're really talking about who could be an effective ally, who could really help bridge some of the disconnects that we're seeing in this MIT community and probably other university communities.
Yeah. You know, embeddedness, of course, is about relationships. Like, it's about real relationships, real interpersonal connections that exist and ideally pre-exist, right? We all know that it's much easier to have and build a relationship outside of a crisis. So I think that's where maybe we're all struggling because we were coming out of COVID and a lot of those pre-existing relationships frayed a bit. And, you know, now we're in the position of trying to activate connections and relationships that are much weaker than they used to be.
Well, I think we have an example because we're one of the few business schools that was actually open during COVID.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, when COVID ended and we were in person again, what we discovered was that the relationship that we, the administration, including you, that we had with our students were often based on relationships. Okay. And yet we had this class, maybe two classes, that we had never built those kinds of relationships with. And so we're like, what's going on here? And we had right. to step back and appreciate, oh, here's what's going on here. This is a relationship-driven place. And COVID stopped those relationships from forming and developing. And instead of us looking and wondering what's wrong, we need to ask ourselves, what's missing? Right? And it turns out those relationships are missing and we need to really start to invest in building them again. And we just took them for granted.
Yeah. I love that perspective. I didn't think we were going to go there to this, but I think it resonates with a lot of observations of the past year is that some of what the dynamics we were seeing where people are seeking out support, seeking out community was reflecting a lot of things that are going on. But one of them was the lack that you described. But Lillian, your research on Liberia, right? You're giving us a very concrete, I think, strong piece of evidence for the importance of community embeddedness, right?
So, you know, this research that we did during the Ebola epidemic in Liberia was interested in understanding how the Ministry of Health in Liberia was able to actually build trust with the citizenry so quickly. They were coming out of this post-conflict setting, post-war setting, where the trust in government, the Ministry of Health, was incredibly low. During the Civil War, authorities did these really atrocious things. For example, there were reports that those in authority would intentionally deprive the population of food in order to increase the amount of humanitarian aid that they could get. And so there was really a lot of reason for the public, the citizenry, not to have any trust in authorities. So the Ebola epidemic starts, right? And of course, they need to have some epidemic control measures in place really, really quickly. And so what they finally stumbled upon, figured out, was that they identified people within communities who were embedded in those communities, who lived and worked in those communities, who were willing to act as guarantors of the Ministry of Health, that they would, in essence, lend their credibility to the government. And I call them guarantors because they were embedded, their fellow neighbors knew that if it turned out that they were lying, they could be held accountable, the people who were in the communities themselves. And so that was, coming back to costly signals, an extremely costly signal for the people who were willing to vouch for the Ministry of Health and put their own safety, their own family's safety on the line.
So in other words, I'm taking a big risk. I'm a member of the community. I'm taking a big risk because I'm vouching for the government's efforts to members of my community. And if I turn out to be wrong, and the government has a bad track record, you're saying, right? Then I suffer significant reputational cost. Like, you know,
I think it was more than being frozen out. They would hand out their addresses. They would say things like, you know, if it turns out the government is lying, you know where I live, you know where my children go to school, you know what, you know how to hurt us, actually.
Yeah, talk about, you know, self-doxing.
Yeah,
we're talking
exactly
about, right?
Right, exactly. Right. So,
and what gave them the confidence to do that?
It was a combination of seeing enough, getting enough accurate information, seeing enough of what was happening in terms of the government's efforts to address Ebola that they were convinced, right? So that was a matter of actually maybe being in clinics and hospitals, seeing how Ebola victims were actually being medically treated, seeing some of them recover, and learning enough to be confident that the Ministry of Health was actually indeed trying to control Ebola.
And being forward-looking enough to imagine the alternative.
So yes, I mean, I think that comes back to the people who have invested in relationships and trust building over time outside of crisis situations, and then figuring out how to send those kinds of costly signals to be the sort of first mover in a relationship of trust and reciprocity. We know actually that it can be very quick to get these virtuous cycles of trust and reciprocity as long as you have a certain number of first movers who are willing to go out on a limb and trust first.
You need those relationships. So I know there's been a lot of conversations where we've talked about we need the relationships now and let's have some difficult conversations. And I find myself saying, no, let's not have the difficult conversations.
No.
let's just start bringing people together. Let's build the relationships. Maybe later on we'll make them uncomfortable in those relationships, but let's just try to get the relationships in place first.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's interesting. Yes. So the three of us knew each other before October 7th and that particular crisis. And we've also, I think, know each other in part because there have been previous crises. And I guess I'm thinking about the three of us, where I think would roughly be on the same page about how it is that we think about our institution and the challenges. And I think had a high degree of trust in, you know, would be happy to vouch for the good faith and the efforts, even in a challenging situation of our institution. But not all faculty were in that position, right? And that you've got...
But you don't have to guess, Ezra. You have the example of me saying yes to this podcast because you told me that it was something that Lily wanted to do.
Okay, there it is, right? Yeah. Well, you know what? I mean, we all have to do that for each other, right? If we're going to take risks, we ask each other to do that kind of thing. I think what's so challenging about the crisis, right? A, you know, you got a huge institution. Not everybody knows each other. You don't have those relationships in place as you would like across an institution. And number two, sounds like people could see the, like you were saying, right, the counterfactual, like what's a world in which we don't address an Ebola crisis if we're all on the same page of what that means. But if basically you've got a situation where half of the community sees a crisis in one way, and half of the community, it's not even half, really. Half of those who are most engaged, as we're talking about, right? It's not even close to half, but people who are most engaged in feeling it are feeling it in sort of an opposite way. And the moves that you would make to shore up trust to one part of a community are sort of the opposite of the moves, or at least it's perceived that way, to be the opposite of the moves that you would do to shore up trust in another part of the community. The virtual cycle that you're charting for us is a little harder to see how to get there, right?
I mean, maybe an intermediate step is thinking a lot more about responsiveness and listening. I mean, coming back to this calibrating how deeply you get into things, I wonder whether there are ways in which we can have people who are curious and interested actually just listen to the different perspectives that exist in the conflicts that we've been seeing. And those people are not on the other side, actually. They're just interested, curious colleagues and community members. And I think that there are a lot of people in the community who actually just, they want to understand a little bit more about why this side feels so strongly about something, but they're number one, afraid to ask. And number two, they're not necessarily ready to say whether they agree or not, but they want to understand. So I wonder if we can actually work on those pieces, the responsiveness and the listening piece, even before we're trying to build trust and new relationships and connections.
You're describing something it's hard for us. Because what she just basically said was, I want to bring you, Ezra, to a situation, and I just want you to listen. I didn't use myself because we already know I don't listen well. I just want you to listen and not judge. We don't do that. We spend the vast majority of our time as academics listening and reacting and judging very quickly. And she said, can we create a space where it's understood that you're just there to listen and learn? I'm sorry. That's not our natural state of the world. Our natural state is to react, evaluate, and judge immediately after listening.
I also wonder whether it's almost because
I'm saying it's perfect for us to, I'm thinking what you're describing is perfect. And I just wanted to point out how different it is from what normally.
I think it's very, I'm agreeing with you, Ray. Like, it's actually very difficult for us to do that. And maybe it's difficult because other people expect us to make a judgment because that's what we do in workshops and talks. Maybe it's because we expect ourselves to make a judgment really quickly. And it would be, I think, quite wonderful if we could explicitly give ourselves permission to just listen and then go away and think about that. And I also wonder whether it would be quite useful for certain groups to feel like they had been listened to without a snap judgment or evaluation. And that, you know, one of you was saying, like, part of the problem is that the speed, the pace of things has been so fast. And what we're talking about now has to happen at a much slower pace, actually, right. Which comes back to this thinking I've been doing about how do we slow and cool and enable people to control the distance and intensity at which they engage? Because I think that's how we're going to get, number one, more of the community to be able to be engaged constructively, and number two, to have the very large middle be able to be willing to engage and contribute.
So listen and engage. It's interesting because what does engage mean? I would propose it means to take a risk by trying out ideas, right? So I'm thinking what we want from our students, right? We don't want them just to listen to us, right? We want them to, back to the mode that we're trying to do this podcast, like, oh, I noticed something about you guys are saying this, but actually I'm seeing something a little different. And like, is this right? And not be afraid to say that kind of thing, because you're coming from a position of like curiosity and caring, and like, and then both sides will learn hopefully from that.
But Ezra, there was a long observation period for me to have that insight about the Jewish community. There was a long observation period for you to have that insight about Black family reunions. So yeah, I think this listen before reaction is actually part of what we're describing. Slow it down.
I'm just trying to justify my interrupting all the time.
Some things we expect, and I'm glad that you're willing to show yourself some grace, because Lily's asking members of the community to have some grace. In a context where we expect for things to be fast moving, let's try to create a context where it's okay for things to move a little bit more slowly.
Oh, that for sure. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, we just, I think, need multiple speeds, multiple ways of interacting. And I think we're still trying to create, reinvent, establish all of that. But yes, I think, you know, slower, this is all part of like what I think of as a civic infrastructure, that we still need to build up our civic infrastructure, both within MIT and in society more broadly. So
are you using that term in your current research?
Yeah. In some of the research I'm doing, I'm thinking specifically about digital civic infrastructure,
right.
Which is totally broken or non-existent. But I think just separate from the research, what I would like to talk about is this new Compass class of ours that have been working with me over the last year or more than a year now. probably for the first time, we have faculty from practically all of the departments in the School of Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences working together on one class for undergraduates that really tries to provide a space to build community and have conversations about three main questions. You know, number one, what do we value and why do we value it? Number two, how do we know what we know? And number three, what do we owe to each other and why?
Wow.
It's in the spirit of trying to create, experiment with building some of this new civic infrastructure that, separate from crises and conflicts, you know, is just there. It's just exists. And I think that, you know, the more experiments that we can have along these lines, I think the better served we are. Because the fact is that I think a lot of us are grappling with the fact that society and demographics are changing really, really rapidly. Like the pace of change has just increased exponentially over the last 100 years. I was looking at these data and it was so amazing because there's an economist who's, you know, tried their very best to gather what data they can. And of course, it's like, you know, has a huge margin of error. But what they've found is that for the first 1900 years of the last 2000 years of human history, GDP per capita, so to speak, increases something like three or four times over the first 1900 years. Over the last 100 years, it increases something like 30 times.
Wow.
And I don't think that we now, like, we're only starting to realize that what we know from our lifetime is actually totally different from most of human history, and it's getting faster. And I think that makes it really hard for all of us. Like, we're really struggling to figure out how to deal with the pace of change, the pace of social change.
Get a kind of a social terra firma of some kind.
Yeah. I mean, how do institutions keep up with that? Like, we haven't thought about how to reinvent and adapt our institutions that quickly.
Interesting. And you were saying, if you're talking about, say, diversity with respect to, you know, on many dimensions, folks that we now are trying to
accommodate that.
Yeah. And try to incorporate and include, it's not surprising that we might be a little bit challenging.
Yeah.
Just the potential for inequality. That's what you're describing. I mean,
And the forms of inequality that are now we're now sensitive to, that we would never,
sensitive to. So Lily, I think the Compass class that you're building with the students, that you guys are building with the students, are fantastic ideas. Well, I think those are three questions that, for example, the members of our staff, we could ask ourselves. I think those are great questions for us to ask, right? What do we value? How do we know what we know? Oh my goodness. And what do we owe each other? I think that's what I heard you say.
Yeah, that's exactly what, I mean, that's what we've come up with. And, you know, if we can all just be asking those questions and talking about them, I think that would be really helpful. And it's not just for the students, it's for all of us too. Like, you know, I actually think, you know, this podcast series has a lot to do with those questions, actually.
There's a lot more that one can do to really refine what it is that we know. That's the question, that those three questions that are all three very, very important. People, I think, should have in mind that this is part of an ongoing conversation. We want to hear from people about what they know, about how they react to this, as part of an ongoing attempt to try to know it just a little bit more and to be able to hopefully be in position to make things just a little bit better.
So thank you for having the wisdom and vision of seeing the importance of this podcast.
Yeah. Well, thanks to the two of you for actually doing it. That was easy.
All right. Thank you, Lily. That's a wrap.
I'm Ray Reagans.
I'm Ezra Zuckerman-Sivan.
You've been listening to Outsider
Insider,
a podcast from MIT.
Special thanks for this amazing two-part episode to our dear colleague and friend, Lily Tsai.
Special thanks. And as always, we're grateful to our producer, Lucy McCormick. I'm sorry, Lucy, our producer, who got stuck on the side of a mountain trying to see a comet.
Chasing a comet.
Our producer is a comet chaser.
We won't tell her that you can't actually catch the comet, but
can't catch it.
But actually, Lucy can. We'll find out more about that at some point, hopefully.
With help from consulting producer Mei Mei
and audio mix by Hans Del Shi. And let's also not forget to thank our executive producer, Cato Sullivan.
Cato Sullivan.